Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Marius Ruart. Marius, how are you?
Good afternoon, Nick.
And Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you, sir. So let's start off with perhaps what's one of the most important news stories that's not really getting that much coverage, which is the re-establishment of the Section 25 Review Committee in Parliament, which shows that in many cases we are returning to life before COVID, even as COVID cases spike. This committee was seeking to look at the amending of the Constitution for what would eventually allow expropriation without compensation. Terence, tell us a little bit about what's going on here.
Yeah, well, these committees sort of have a finite lifespan, and the committee that was investigating the question of whether, or not whether, but how Section 25 would be amended in order to help expropriation without compensation along, that committee had lapsed. Now, what Parliament has done is essentially resurrected it. I don't think the I'm not 100% sure if the particular members have been assigned to it yet, but I think that the big point here is to is that this demonstrates that this policy agenda has not gone away. Why that is important is because when the pandemic hit, we were hearing from a lot of people that Cyril's got this is his opportunity. Expropriation without compensation is such a nutcase idea, and it's going to do so much damage that this is the moment that he will strike and he will push it off. Well, no, this shows that even under these conditions, when the economy is looking at shrinking by 7%, I think that's going to be conservative. Even as our unemployment rate is now over 30%, and those are figures from before the pandemic. Even while the economic damage of the pandemic and the associated lockdown is being hailed as being worse than the Great Depression. This is something that is being forced along. There is an ideological commitment behind this that ignores all good sense, and this is something that the government and the ruling party are determined to make South Africa pay for.
So, Marius, we've had this problem many times over, where Ramaphosa seems to be unable to change course, or he charts a course and then sort of just sticks to it. Doggedly, as we're seeing now. This, as Terence says, this pandemic would have given him a perfect opportunity to say, comrades, look, the situation has changed. We need to start looking at alternative ways. We can go back to expropriation when we're on safer footing, something like that. And yet he's shown no sign that he's doing it. Is it because he's malicious, or is it because he's weak?
I don't know. I think President Ramaphosa believes in, I think he's probably more on the side of the more radical economic transformation side of people in the ANC, I think. I think this belief that Cyril Ramaphosa is this great reformer and his hands are tied by the Ace Magashule's of the ANC, the longer this carries on, I think it's clear that that's false. As you say, the president had lots of opportunity to set South Africa on a different course, and especially just after he'd won election last year, or just after he became ANC president, was the president of South Africa in 2018. Those were golden opportunities for him to put South Africa onto a much more sustainable economic path. And he'll have support. It'd be very hard for the president probably would have been one of the most popular South African politicians after he'd won the election last year, I think. That would have been the exact time for him to start implementing proper economic reforms, but he didn't. We've got to think why. He's either believes in the ideology of the ANC, which is probably likely, or his hands are tied by the RET faction of the ANC. And I think I don't think his hands are tied. I think he agrees with a lot of what they say. And I think this is also, I think this is ideology, and also the need for the ANC to keep its patronage taps flowing. Because ANC now, one of its almost the sole reason for existing now is patronage. And I think that's why we saw the ANC is trying to save SAA or resurrect SAA, because it makes no no sense, no logical sense whatsoever to try to save SAA, except from the point of view that it's a great patronage doling out machine. And I think that's probably EWC is going to be seen as well as that way of that too. We saw in Zimbabwe when farms were expropriated by ZANU-PF. They didn't go to people who used to live on there or people whose grandfathers maybe had been kicked off the land. They went to, you know, ZANU-PF cronies. And we've all heard the stories. I think Grace Mugabe owns something like 5 farms or something like that. So I think EWC is it's partly an ideological issue, but also it's a way to keep the patronage taps flowing in the ANC. For the ANC.
So, Terence, I think people do get a bit confused when they hear that the constitution is being changed and that kind of thing, because everyone sort of expects it to happen tomorrow. Mm. But these processes kind of drag on forever. And I know it's difficult to predict how long this will go on for, but how long do you think it's actually going to be until the government sort of starts to sink its teeth into property? I mean, are we talking months, years?
Well, you know, to the extent that this has really done no small amount of damage, it's already sunk its teeth into property. You know, look, I mean, I have personally spoken to people, and I'm just, you know, ordinary members of the public who talk about how they are reluctant to buy a house now because of this. And, you know, I think that there's some sense to that. Initially, there was some suggestion about the committee wanting to get its work done by the end of this year, which I don't think is feasible because there are duties of consultation and whatnot that are going to be very, very difficult to do under these circumstances. That doesn't mean that that it won't be pushed along, and I think that there's a huge danger of complacency. There was a wonderful letter actually attacking the Institute at the beginning, towards the beginning of the pandemic, which ran in a major newspaper saying, Cyril's got this. Worm Cyril has got this. And saying, well, you know, now we're going to see the reformer coming out. Well, I'd love to sit down and have a virtual chat with that writer now. But, okay, changing the constitution is what? Yeah.
I just want to say, I believe that writer is also based in Berlin. So it's also quite easy to tell South Africans to be sanguine about the future when you happily ensconced in a European country that protects property rights.
It's funny how people who are free from any of the consequences are often sitting in plush places overseas telling us how great we have it.
Yes, no, there is certainly some truth to that. Many of Robert Mugabe's biggest cheerleaders didn't live in Zimbabwe. But you change the constitution. That's one step. What that does is it limits the scope for a constitutional challenge. In other words, you are saying that there's no rule of the game that says that, you know, the government can't do this. That doesn't establish the whole framework. You need a law then to enable that. That will come with a new expropriation law.
I think we've lost Terence there. We'll just have to wait for him to get back.
But I just wanted to also make the point that people might say your house in the suburbs isn't going to be expropriated or whatever. And that's probably right. I don't think if EWC does happen, I don't think, you know, your 3-bedroom townhouse in the Grandberg is going to be taken away. But remember, if we lose property rights, then we'll see a collapse in the broad economy. And your house might be safe, but its value is going to be nothing, and there'll be a massive outflow of investments in South Africa. And we are, I mean, we've all seen this movie before. We saw it in lots of countries around the world. We saw it just across the river in Limpopo. I mean, across the Limpopo in Zimbabwe. So there's, you know, we all know how this ends, and it always ends in tears. So I think any South African who wants a prosperous future should know that EWC is a threat to everybody who wants a South Africa that works and that can be a decent place for everybody to live here.
Right. The bill that has been introduced but is going through some reworking defined expropriation in such a way that in order for it to, for a particular deprivation to count as expropriation, the government would have to take ownership. But there are precedents where it can take custodianship. So, you know, you can lose your property, but the government doesn't technically take it, or it just deprives you of it. And I think that this is sort of the end game, to expand that that field as widely as possible. We believe that one of the things that is in the pipeline is a drive to have all land in South Africa nationalized along the lines of water and mineral rights. In other words, property and land just won't be possible, private property. It will all be everything will be under the custodianship of the state, which is, I think, the closest thing we have to that is the way that that most of the former homelands operate, where land is held in, you know, in trust for the people by the by a traditional leader on behalf of the state, and that's been one of the festering sores of our post-apartheid dispensation. So yes, look, there is some distance to go, and it's important that each and every one of these be contested. You know, I think that if we go right back to these sort of early hearings of the about whether or not the constitution should be changed, I think it's this has a very strong odor about it that the decision was taken long before the first crowd had been convened, or the first submission had been received, and you know we kept up quite closely with developments there. And the number of submissions that were opposed to changing the constitution, that's just the question of changing, far exceeded those in favor. Ace Magashule then responded, no, but verbal submissions count more than written submissions. So that's all good. A President Ramaphosa himself, before the hearings were even concluded, announced that we will be changing the constitution. On the basis that our people, that phrase, you know, are in favor of doing it. He's never specified who these our people are, but obviously they do not include those who had actually made submissions. So this whole process, I think, has been deeply, deeply and fundamentally flawed. And I think it's vulnerable to challenge on many, many fronts. And, you know, we will do whatever we can to stop South Africa from going down this blind alley.
No, definitely. One shudders to think about the opportunities for maladministration and corruption that would emerge if all land was nationalized. And of course, it's also equally disturbing that, the difference, apparently, according to the president, between who is and who is not a South African, or at least a South African he represents, is whether you agree or not with changing the constitution. But let's move on to another interesting constitutional matter, which is the conflict over language rights, particularly Afrikaans. So UNISA, a while ago, decided that it was going to remove Afrikaans from the university as a language of instruction, as a medium of instruction. They went through a process, and there was a legal challenge by AfriForum against this. And now the High Court judgment found that UNISA's English only language policy was all right, but now the Supreme Court of Appeal has rejected that. So this is probably going to end up I suspect in some of the highest courts at the Constitutional Court. Maurice says, what's sort of the background to this? Because we've seen other talk about language and language rights and cultural groups and all that recently in the media. What else is going on at the moment?
Well, so what happened was that AfriForum appealed this ruling because the Gauteng High Court had said in 2018 that English should be the primary language of instruction at UNISA. So they obviously appealed this, and the Supreme Court of Appeal now said that removing Afrikaans as a medium of instruction was unlawful. And they actually upheld AfriForum's appeal with cost. So it's quite a big victory for AfriForum. So, I think this is... It's kind of symbolic of South Africa at the moment. Some people say wanting to be taught in Afrikaans is part of their cultural heritage and so on. And then others will say that, you know, wanting to be taught in Afrikaans means you don't want to, you hearken for the past and whatever the case is. And I think there's probably, you know, you can probably make arguments for both sides, but I do think there's a mistake to kind of take, you know, not allow any of the universities to have Afrikaans as a medium of instruction. I think recently we saw at Stellenbosch, English is also, I'm not sure the exact details, but I think English is the primary language of instruction at Stellenbosch now as well. So I think in if we want to be in a pluralist society that works, I think we need to accept that people will want to learn in other languages that aren't necessarily English. And I don't think there's any problem with if we decide, if we had to say, for example, University of Potchefstroom and Stellenbosch are going to be the two Afrikaans medium universities in South Africa and let them, you know, teach in Afrikaans. I think as demographics change and so on, I think there might be a much low demand for Afrikaans instruction anyway in South Africa. And I think a lot of people probably want to learn English anyway, seeing as that's the kind of, you know, international lingua franca. So, but I do think it's, you know, if we want to live in a society where we are, if you want to be a bit twee about it and say united in our diversity, I think we should allow people to, you know, study in Afrikaans if they so wish. And I think we're also seeing they've been, I don't know if we should call them attacks on Afrikaans. We've definitely seen a bit of a strange attitude to Afrikaans from, in particular, Panyaza Lesufi, who's the MEC for Education in Gauteng. He claims that he doesn't have a problem with Afrikaans schools, but we've seen some of his actions in Gauteng indicate that he looks like he certainly does. And I think it was last week he said he's going to go to the Constitutional Court about the issue of Orania, the town in the Northern Cape, which is only for white Afrikaners, and say, you know, it's not something we can allow in South Africa in 2020. But I mean, I really don't think that 2,000 Afrikaners living in the deserts is one of the most pressing issues in South Africa at the moment. I think we have much more pressing issues that Panyaza Lesufi would be much better served if he actually, you know, focused on looking at, you know, how many schools there are still with pit latrines in South Africa, for example.
I think that's, of course, a good point. And my question to you, Terence, is we always sort of seem to see these fights kind of be started, basically, by often ANC-aligned groups or the ANC itself, sometimes out of the blue. I mean, Panyaza Lesufi's attack on Orania recently is quite strange, I think, because it sort of seems to have been prompted by nothing in particular. I've heard the theory postulated that often attacks on Afrikaans or other sort of symbols of the past are deliberately chosen by the ANC as a way to kind of stoke racial tensions to distract from other issues that may be going on. Would you say that's plausible?
Look, I think that you know, your starting point here is to recognize that there is a very, very strong strand of racial nationalism that goes through the ANC. This is, you know, this is not and the reason I say racial nationalism or ethnic nationalism is that it's something that is inherently exclusive. You know, you can't, it's very difficult for an outsider to buy into that or to be accepted into it. You know, this distinction between ethnic and civic nationalism here. Now, the whole new South Africa idea was supposed to be based on that civic nationalist impulse, united in a diversity, blah blah blah. And I remember the question of Afrikaans educations and Afrikaans culture and whatever. In the early 90s, and I remember Nelson Mandela saying that, you know, as long as no black or brown child is excluded from attending it, a school teaching in Afrikaans is just fine. But I think that there was always a great deal of tension. I think that there's a lot of hostility towards Afrikaans specifically, and you know, you can make all these arguments about how, you know, more brown people than white people speak it. I don't think that's the point. I think for many people carrying an Africanist African nationalist ideology, it is seen very much through the lens of the kind of language of the oppressor. Now, I think also that that the Constitution was written in the language of civic nationalism and inclusion. But I think that I am minded to agree with what Oren Schlemmer said about this, that this was done in bad faith. That yes, you know, you guarantee 11 languages, and you can just like tag a whole bunch of others, you know, Sanskrit and Khoi and German and whatever, because they you know, used by particular communities, and that's all great. But then you can make a respectable pragmatic argument that in reality you can't do all of this. Why this, I think, is particularly sensitive for people for white Afrikaners, let me say, is that first of all, they are a group that is often directly or indirectly fingered with responsibility for these past misdeeds, but also because Afrikaans fought a very long uphill struggle to become established, and it's been termed a linguistic miracle. Along with Indonesian and Hebrew in the 20th century, it went from this language that was sort of corrupted kitchen Dutch to a language that could do heart bypasses and create nuclear weapons. That was a major achievement. And you know, it's one thing that you know perhaps Afrikaner nationalism can look back on with pride, that they created a language that could do these things. Now, Afrikaans today, I would say, still has a certain privilege in society. You know, I hate that word privilege, but you know, it has a certain prominence. You can go through school, you know, to matric, doing it all in Afrikaans, which is not an option available in Zulu or Tswana, at least as far as I know. You know, those languages just have not had the impulse behind them to be turned into academic and judicial languages the way Afrikaans was. You know, you can say that, well, you know, Afrikaans had the state behind it. But it also had, you know, a great deal of popular appeal. We haven't seen the equivalent thing from African languages. There are some grassroots organizations that try to promote it, but the government has certainly never taken it up. I mean, there was a particularly amusing instance about 10 years ago when a prominent film director, whose name I forget, released a movie, I think it was called Yesterday, about the devastation that AIDS was causing in KwaZulu-Natal. He spoke about his decision to dump English and do this in Zulu. And there were others who came up and spoke at the launch of the movie. But the irony is that every one of them that was talking about what a wonderful future Zulu had did their speech in English. So I do think that there is a great deal of hostility towards Afrikaans on that basis. But you know, even if these arguments are entirely pragmatic, here's the problem. One gentleman I spoke to about this a couple of years ago said, you know, how on earth can you still believe that an Afrikaans language university has a place in the modern South Africa? And I said to him, well, you know, the Constitution guarantees language rights. And he kind of waved that away. And I said, okay, well, let's turn this around. How can you possibly believe free speech has a place or free assembly has a place in South Africa? You know, once we start throwing out, you know, one thing, you know, the others start going out the window a lot faster.
I'd just like to make 2 points there. According to Professor Google, Daryl Ritz is the make yesterday. So just okay. Put that on the record.
All right.
And number two, what was interesting of the SEA's judgment on the Afrikaans issue at UNISA, it was actually released in English and Khoza, which I think that's actually one of those, you know, stories that it's quite nice about South Africa. There's a judgment on the issue of Afrikaans language extraction, which has been, and the judgment's being delivered in English and Khoza, which is, I think, it's quite a nice thing, actually.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the important points here is that as a matter of constitutional integrity, the more you change a document like the Constitution, the less sort of force and permanence it has in society and the weaker a protection it is of all of our rights. And we're now, of course, seeing a big assault on property rights, as we just discussed. But there's now this added one where sort of the right of Afrikaans, which is enshrined in the constitution, is now sort of being hand-waved away and ridden over, or at least attempting to be ridden over by many groups in society. And that is a very troubling thing equally, because regardless of whether you think that that should have been in the original document or not, and I think it should have been, but if you think that it was sort of misplaced or something, by attacking it just after the Bill of Rights is also being changed to have property rights dismantled is going to weaken the integrity of the constitution overall. And if we were to see two major assaults on constitutional rights in short succession, I mean, who knows where that would stop?
Yeah, look, just to follow directly onto that, I think the thing that a lot of people are, you know, have failed to realize about, particularly the drive to amend Section 25, this is the Bill of Rights, the first time that the Bill of Rights has come under this kind of assault. The ANC also, just before the pandemic, changed their views on this and said, well, they want the Constitution to specify that the executive, not the courts, are in charge of this process. You know, and a lot of people who kind of who in the 2 years preceding would say, oh, no, but this is all just going to be about, you know, like clarify, making explicit what is implicit. It's going to be cosmetic. So, yeah, well, you know, be careful. Once those wheels start to turn, they can get out of control very quickly. And once you have this precedent where, okay, we've now managed to successfully scapegoat private property rights for the failures of land reform and economic policy and whatever, you know, how soon is it before we're saying, well, you know, these dreadful muckraking fake news journalists, you know, who are like pointing out things like VBS and Kantler and, you know, all these other weird words that no one really knows about.
They're undermining social cohesion.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, perhaps we need to rethink this whole free speech thing and say, well, you know, it's not about freedom of expression, it's about freedom of positive expression. You know, we'll make Claudie the sort of head of the new People's Bureau of Positivity or something like that, which, you know, will have powers to throw you in the can for 25 years for undermining national morale.
I just want to say one thing on constitutions. I also think sometimes countries can kind of be hamstrung by them. I think the US is probably a good example of that. A lot of the kind of things that, you know, there's such a reluctance to tamper with the Constitution. I think that's kind of maybe why we're seeing, you know, US politics seems a bit broken at the moment. And it might be because people aren't prepared to look at solutions to some of the problems which have come from having a document that's seen as kind of sacred and now is nearly 250 years old. So I think you need the balance between, you know, changing the thing too much and then seeing it as a kind of a sacred parchment that you can't touch.
I'm not sure I agree with you there, but that's a can of worms for another day.
Yeah, you're an Americophile, though, so it's fine.
No, it's not just that. I think that
I agree with Nick on that.
Yeah, with a foundational document, you don't want to go monkeying around with it. If you change the constitution every couple of years, and I know you're calling for a balance here, but it can have a lot of serious consequences. But that's a discussion for another day, which we will have to pick up. And in the meantime, let us just quickly go over to our last point here, which is, and I think I'm just going to go with Marius on this one because we don't have much time. But Bheki Cele has... he was giving comment to the media recently, and he mentioned the fact that while the government was against police brutality, which I think is one of those cases of saying something very safe, that police officers are allowed to use deadly force to defend and protect. We've seen quite a lot of police brutality during the lockdown, I think, and you know, there's been at least 49 cases of police brutality have officially been reported, according to Cele, but there may be more. We saw the murder of Collins Khoza, or at least the assault, the beating of Collins Khoza by
SAID. I think we can't call it murder. I don't think...
Well, I'm not sure of the legalities, but yeah, let's just say that he had a very nasty altercation with some SANDF
personnel. Some JMPD people as well, apparently.
Yeah, and so we've seen people being very negatively affected by security force violence, but this is not a particularly new thing, is it, in South Africa?
No, we've had. I mean, I'm not sure the exact stats, but I know on a per capita basis, the number of people killed by police in South Africa is far higher than the US. And it's quite, I mean, it's I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but I mean, to see, you know, Ramaphosa come out and speak about the terrible stuff that happened to George Floyd, when worse things happen every day in South Africa on his doorstep. I mean, it's, you know, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. But this is an issue we've been having with the police for a while. The Institute has released a number of documents over the years. We call the Broken Blue Line. I wrote the most recent one, which came out in 2018, I think. That was the third one we'd done. And that was looking at how police were involved in, you know, violent criminal activity and so on. And it was actually scary to find, you know, just over a period of about a year, I easily found over 100 incidents, and they ranged from, you know, fairly benign stuff, you know, from people breaking into cars and stealing car radios or valuables, you know, policemen doing that, to, you know, much, much worse stuff, you know, murders and rapes and all that kind of thing. And, you know, I'd say, I mean, it's probably safe to say that over 90% of police and so on are decent people who are trying to do a very hard job. But I think there are a number of rotten apples in it. And we see this, you know, stuff that happened with Collins Khoza and Petrus Michels and, you know, a number of other people during the lockdown period that were killed by the police. And as I say, with the Broken Blue Line reports that we've done, we've seen serious criminality within the SAPS, which is, you know, it's quite worrying. I mean, these are people who, in theory, are supposed to protect ordinary South Africans, but they're actually the ones who often are working with hard criminals or actually are criminals themselves. So, I mean, one really egregious example that comes to mind is, I think it was a guy in the Vaal Triangle, and people were coming into handing their firearms. They didn't want to renew them. They didn't want to renew their licenses. They want to get rid of their guns. And this fellow was selling the weapons to criminal gangs in the Western Cape. So, you know, it's a sad state of affairs. And also just Becky Cele is really, I mean, it's actually mind-boggling that the man's the Minister of Police, but, you know, even President Jacob Zuma fired him because he was even too corrupt for President Zuma, and now he's the Minister of Police in South Africa, so it's quite something.
Terence, final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, you say that it's difficult to understand what's going through his mind when he gets on his moral pony about events in the United States. While, you know, you can, those sort of things are dime a dozen. Yeah, this comes down to what I was talking about, racial nationalism. There's a very good booklet written by Howard Burrell about the nature of the ANC, and point he makes is that it sees its own mission tied up with that of black people around the world. So you know, this also explains why there can be this enormous reaction against H&M with an off color advert, while China TV has the Lunar New Year broadcast that's full of blackface, monkey imagery, you know, grotesque prosthetics to represent Africa, and that doesn't raise an eyelid. You know, I wish that this concern was motivated by a sense of anger and injustice, but I just don't see it. You know, as far as police behavior goes, you know, we as a country, you know, once again, go back to the transition. There was this idea of introducing community policing, but that stripped a lot of the a lot of the detective capabilities, and you know, we sort of halfway made this transition, but also halfway didn't. So, you know, you have a police force that is theoretically supposed to be engaging in one type of policing, which is human rights based, you know, in collaboration with communities, but is not capacitated or in a position to really deliver that. You know, I've also, and I think a lot of people come into the force without adequate training to deal with the type of challenges that they're going to face. I mean, I was told by one guy who's a long-term veteran that one of the first things they do with new arrivals is put them on a Saturday afternoon shift and wait for that first drunken, disorderly comment to come in. They drive him over, say, okay, you go into that bar, Shabin, whatever, and arrest the guy. No, but he doesn't know how to use handcuffs or whatever. Right, now your training's about to start. And, you know, after the guy's like shillelied a whiskey bottle at him, he realizes this is not what he's been taught. And, you know, some are able to adapt. I think many just kind of give up and just think that, you know, clapping guys for stepping out of line is just a more rewarding pastime. Sad, very sad. And obviously, I think it is a grave disservice to those many who try their best, and many who go in quite idealistically.
No, I definitely agree with Terence there. There's a big problem with morale in the police force, and I think a lot of people really struggle to work in the environment because police are kind of left out to dry. And the violence we often see from cops is really more a sign of weakness, of the fact that they don't feel like they're making much of a much progress against criminals. They don't feel like they're able to contain them properly, and so they resort to sort of very crude, brutal tactics. And those then spill out into their sort of general behavior towards the public, which is, of course, not really acceptable. But anyway, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your input today. And thank you to all of our listeners. We enjoy these podcasts, or at least I do very much. And it's lovely to have you along with us for the ride. And if you're a friend of the Institute, we'd like to extra thank you for making these possible. Your donations, your monthly donations, help us to keep the flag of liberty flying. Thanks very much, everyone, and we'll see you on the Friday edition of the Daily Brent Show.